My talk tonight is going to be a little different than talks you've heard in the past. It's not going to be about practice or aspects of practice. It's actually be more of the history of the insight meditation movement in this country. I thought about this a while ago, speaking to people. A lot of people didn't know the history of how the practice got started and how it's evolved here. So I thought it would be fun to go into it. There's some fun aspects. We'll start off with the story of the Buddha. And there's a lot of mythology around the story of the Buddha. But it said around 100,000 eons ago, he was named Sumedha. And at that time, the Buddha of that age was called Dipankara. And the Buddha was an ascetic at, Sumedha was an ascetic at that time, and he heard that the Buddha, Dipankara, was going to be coming to the local village. And he was so awe-inspired by him that when he saw him coming, it said there was a there was like a puddle which he had the Buddha had to walk over, and so he put his body down so the Buddha could walk over his body and so his feet wouldn't get wet. And at that time, Dipankara prophesied that in many eons Sumedha would become the Buddha of this age. And I once calculated how long 100,000 eons would be, and basically the universe would have come and gone thousands of times. So we went through many, many births and deaths, perfecting his generosity and virtue. So he would become a Buddha. It said that at the time of Dipankara, he actually could have become fully enlightened. But what a Buddha is an, the theory goes, or the myth goes, in every age, a Buddha comes, and the Buddha is the first one in that age to become enlightened. And so he wanted to bring the Dharma to a future age, be the first one, and so he practiced for 100,000 eons. When he was born, he was born into the princely caste of the Shakyas, and his father was the king in a region in Nepal. And it was prophesied by an astrologer that Siddhartha was his name, that he would either become a great king or a great spiritual leader. His father, wanting him to become a king, did everything he could to make sure that he would become a king. Also, after 7 days, his mother died, and his aunt raised him. And so what his father did is his father wanted to shelter him from all forms of sorrow and sadness in life, and so he always had delightful people around him, and he had a summer palace, the winter palace, and the winter palace was in the cooler region. I mean, the summer palace was in the cooler regions, and the winter palace was in the warmer regions, so we'd never know discomfort. But one day, he decided he wanted to go out with his attendant, and he went out and he saw what's called the four harbingers, or the four messengers, and he saw an old person, which supposedly he never saw before. And he saw a sick person, and then he saw a dead person. And then he also saw a wandering ascetic look very happy. And he realized that all the power and wealth he had and happiness could disappear once he got old and he died, and he can also get sick, and all the people he loved can get sick and die. And he felt a great sadness, and he had real compassion to find how to put an end to this. So also at that time, his wife gave birth to their son, Raula, and it said it was very trying for him to go and leave the ascetic life because he had his family there. But he went into the ascetic life, and he cut his hair off and put on robes and got rid of his royal clothes. And he went looking for a teacher, and the first teacher he studied under was Arata. And Arata had a system and philosophy and a system of meditation which would lead to what's called the sphere of nothingness. And in Buddhist practice, there are various concentration states. Some of the advanced ones are called the formless concentration states, and the second highest one is called the sphere of nothingness. And so he was able to enter that quite easily, which was quite an accomplishment. It takes a lot of concentration, a lot of discipline, and for many people, years and years of practice, and he was able to master that quite quickly. And Arata wanted him to stay and help teach, but he felt that he didn't solve the problem. How does he find an end to suffering and sorrow? And because when he came out of this great state of the sphere of nothingness, he still was left with having sorrow and suffering, seeing that. So then he went looking for another teacher, and he studied under Rudraka Ramaputra, and he had a more sublime philosophical system and meditation system, and his led to the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. And he mastered that quite quickly, and Ramaputra asked him to stay, and he felt that this was not the end of his quest. So then he went into the forest, and he did ascetic practices for 6 years, and there were five other people who he hung out with, and they were all impressed with his ascetic practices. He hardly ate anything. Places say he only ate one grain of rice a day. And after these 6 years, he realized he was dying, and so this was definitely not the path to salvation. And he said this was fruitless, and that's where he realized that he must practice the middle way, that both extremes of indulgence and severe deprivation was not the way to go. So that's when he started to nourish himself back to health. And after he nourished himself back to health, he gained strength, and he sat down on a Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, India. And when he sat down, he remembered when he was a child sitting under a tree while his father was doing work. And at that time, when he was a child, he entered what was called the first stage of concentration or absorption. And he remembered how pleasant and happy he was. And he realized that that was a pleasure that was born of seclusion. And so this kind of pleasure he didn't consider unskillful. Now then in various texts I looked at, there's a number of stories. If you've seen the movie Little Buddha, they act out what happened on the night of his enlightenment, and they show Mara, who's, as Gill says, Mara's number one job is to make sure people don't get enlightened, and it shows that Mara sent his daughters and tempting him and throwing arrows at him and everything else. Another version said after some temptation, he discovered dependent origination, which Gill is going to talk about tomorrow. But in many of the texts I looked at, they all said that in the first watch of the night, he saw his past lives. And it's not clear how many past lives, but I read one place he saw all the way back to the time he took the vow to become a Buddha, which is a lot of past lives, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of past lives he saw. In the second watch of the night, he saw beings being born and dying in various world systems according to their karma. And then in the third watch of the night is where he became enlightened. In the what I've read in the Digha Nikaya 26th, it says, in the third watch of the night, he turned and directed his concentrated mind to the destruction of the taints. He directly saw the Four Noble Truths. When it was liberated, there came knowledge. It is liberated. I directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, and what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And at that point, he was liberated, and he enjoyed the bliss of liberation for several weeks, it said, sitting under the Bodhi tree. And he didn't think people would really understand what he discovered because it was very subtle. And it said that the god Brahma came to him and said, there are many beings in the world who have but a little dust in their eyes, and if just remove them, that they would become enlightened. And so the first people he wanted to teach was Arada and Ramaputra. But he realized with his divine vision that they already left their bodies and were in the sphere of nothingness or neither perception or non-perception, which it said you're there for more than 100,000 eons. So he went and he taught the ascetics that he hung around with in the forest, and then went on to teach from there. He taught the Four Noble Truths and then went on to teach for 40 years. So, you know, in the center, this is Insight Meditation Center, or the Pali word for insight is Vipassana, and that's the main teaching we teach here. And where does that come from? Well, the Buddha taught a sutra called the Satipatthana Sutra, or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And the way it's talked about in the sutra is a little different than the way it's taught here or traditionally taught in the West. But there's four parts, mindfulness of the body, which many of you may know, but it's actually there's a lot more parts to it than what's taught here. Mindfulness of feelings, and what they mean by feelings is when experience enters our awareness, is to notice whether that experience is pleasant or unpleasant or neither unpleasant or pleasant. And then there's mindfulness of mind states and mindfulness of dharmas. So mindfulness of the body, and it's actually called contemplation of the body. And it starts out with mindfulness of breathing, contemplating the body internally, externally, contemplating its arising and vanishing factors. And so some of that is taught here, and we're traditionally taught to start out with following your breath. And then if your mind wanders, you go back to your breath. Or you can work on being mindful of your posture, or if you have aches or pains, to be mindful of that. But the second contemplation of mindfulness of the body is the four postures of meditation. And the four postures of meditation is sitting, lying down, walking or standing. And those are all forms of meditation. Traditionally here, we teach meditation while sitting and meditation while walking. I only know one teacher in the Vipassana movement who teaches meditation of standing. We did that on one retreat. And meditation of sitting, of lying down, is difficult because the tendency of falling asleep. There's a number of people who have back problems in this center and other centers who practice that, and it actually can be done without falling asleep. The third contemplation is called foulness of body parts, or traditionally called the repulsiveness of the body, or as Gill says, contemplating various fluids that come out of your body that you wouldn't want on your pillow at night. And actually the purpose of that meditation, which is rarely taught here, is to break people's attachment to the body, that we do have bodies which we like and we find beautiful and we find other people's beautiful. But there's a very famous, I can't think of the woman, sexy actress who says, you know, her liver is no different than anybody else's liver. So if you contemplate people's liver, you have a different view of people's bodies. The fourth contemplation is contemplation of the elements, and that's seeing the body in its four elements, and that's air, water, wind, and fire. Fire is the heat element. Did I get that correct? Okay. Earth, that's right. Earth is the solidness of the body. Water is the fluidity aspect. Fire is the heat, hot and cold. And air, it's more like the breath going in and out. The fifth contemplation, which is definitely not done here in America, though you can do variants of it, is nine different contemplations that you do at the charnel grounds. That's where they burn bodies for cremation. And it's basically sitting at bodies and watching them get all bloated. And there's a story the Buddha tells of there was a woman who was a, I don't know the word for a high-class prostitute, basically, and people went and paid to be with her. And then she died, and they had her body out there decomposing, and the Buddha asked people, how much do you want to pay to be with her now? The second foundation is the mindfulness of feelings or contemplation of feelings. I talked about that already. The third is contemplation of a mind, and that is knowing your state of mind, mind states. And the text says when the meditator, let's say, is filled with lust, the meditator knows the mind is filled with lust. When the meditator is not filled with lust, the meditator knows they're not filled with lust. When the meditator's mind is concentrated, the meditator knows the mind is concentrated, and so forth, all various mind states. Also, with all of these, they talk about in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is internally and externally, and externally is rarely talked about in the West, but basically with all these states, knowing that you have anger or joy, but also contemplating that everybody else has those states. The last one is contemplation of mind objects or dharmas. And this one is, in all the retreats I've been on, usually go progressively through this to some form or another. But like I said, not with the, of course, the charnel ground. They don't do those meditations or retreat, or the foulness of the body parts is not done in retreat. But I've seen element meditations done, four postures meditation, and mindfulness of breathing done on retreats. But contemplation of mind objects I've never seen done in retreat. And I heard if you sit a real long retreat, they may do it towards the end. But the mind objects are the five hindrances, which I know there have been talks here before. The five hindrances are sensual craving or desire, anger or hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. And it's knowing when those are in the mind. The second is the contemplation of the five aggregates. And the five aggregates are material form, feelings, perceptions, intentions, and consciousness, in the way the text talks about it. Such is material form, such is its origin, such is its disappearance. And then you go through all the others. The next contemplation of mind object is the six bases, internal and external, it says in the text. A bhikkhu understands the eye, he understands forms, he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both, and he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unrisen fetter, how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. And you go through that with all the six sense bases, the five senses, and the six being the mind or thoughts going through the mind, perception of that. And then goes in the seven factors of enlightenment, which is mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, equanimity, and then the Four Noble Truths. And one can give a talk on each of these things. But as I said, a lot of this isn't traditionally taught today, and so what happened between 2,500 years ago and now? There were many schools that developed at the time of the Buddha, and even Theravada Buddhism, which is the lineage of this center, which means the teachings of the elders, is not even wasn't even originally around at the time of the Buddha. And so actually, none of the original schools exist from the time of the Buddha, but the Theravada is considered the closest. Theravada Buddhism today thrives in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia. And very few in these countries, very few lay people meditate. Matter of fact, very few monks meditate in these countries. It's only around 10% of the monks meditate. But lay people are, a lot of them are interested in acquiring merit, and they do this by giving alms to monks, involved in rites and rituals, building monasteries, and many people are interested in obtaining good future births, so they do these things. In some way, you might say Buddhism is like an organized religion in these countries. If you want to know about living in a Buddhist family, Bhante Gudaratna, who's a monk and lives in West Virginia and has a center there, and is a really wonderful person. He recently came out with his autobiography, and he talked about when he was a little girl in Sri Lanka, and they'd go to the local temple to hear the monk talk, and the talks would go out the whole night, and of course, being a little child, they'd be restless and want to do other stuff, and they'd be running around, and the parents would be falling asleep, and they really wanted the children to show respect. And there's degrees of the talks that the monks would give to the laity. Some of them would be real fire and brimstone talks. I have an example of one talk. You like this? It says, "You should renounce evil and cultivate goodness. Being fortunate enough to be born human, don't waste the good opportunity now. Our status as human beings is a very noble one. Avoid all animal-like behavior. Otherwise, you'll sink below the animals and be much more wretched as well. When you eventually fall into hell, your torturous existence there will be far more grievous than that of any animal. So don't do evil." Real fire and brimstone lecture there. Over time, I said only 10% of the monks meditated, but even a lot of monks didn't believe it was worthwhile to meditate. Bhante Gudaratna talks about that in his book, that they didn't think anybody could really accomplish anything by meditating. Luckily, Bhante Gudaratna didn't listen to them and decided to take up mindfulness practice anyway. In Thailand, the government thought that nirvana and the high concentration states was unobtainable in this age, and so it was not worthwhile to do. However, within the last 100 years, there's been a number of teachers who have really brought back the practices, and the two in particular I want to talk about, because they're like the lineage which feeds into this center. The first one is Achan Mun, who was born in 1870 and died in 1949, of Thailand, and the second one is Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma. Achan Mun, along with his teacher Fra Ajahn Sao Kantisiko Mahatera, and he lived from 1861 to 1941, they reestablished the Thai forest tradition, which was dying out. And in the Thai forest tradition, the monks just lived in the forest and would wander around and meditate and live very meek lives. But many of them were very accomplished. After a while, some of them did settle down into some monasteries. Achan Mun was considered very accomplished, both for his insight and concentration practices. And he was the teacher of Achan Cha. And for those of you who know Jack Kornfield, who's one of Gill's teachers, Jack Kornfield was a monk under Achan Cha. And Tan Jeff, who has spoken here a number of times, traces his lineage back to Achan Mun. Mahasi Sayadaw was considered not only a great scholar, but a meditation master. He headed a large meditation center in Rangoon, and actually there would be like thousands of people meditating. Like Gil talks about how you'd see rows and rows of people just meditating there. A lot of the Burmese people would take their vacations at that monastery. He either developed or perfected the mental noting that's used in meditation. I don't know if you've learned in Gil talks about an introductory course, but noting when you have a thought come up or a sensation, but actually, and just continuing noting, whatever sensations come up. It's also said he was, before his time, people just concentrated on the nostrils, and he's responsible for saying it was okay to follow the rising and falling of the abdomen. At his intensive retreat centers, people would meditate for 16 hours a day, doing walking and sitting meditation, and concentration really builds quickly in that. His writings detail give very great detail about his method of teaching, and it goes all the way up from the noting all the way up to nirvana. And the first stage of enlightenment is called stream entry, and Gil said his center was known as a stream entry factory because so many people were entering stream entry. And as I said, Jack Kornfield practiced there. Munindra, we may have heard of his practice, and I'll talk more about him in a minute. Usilananda practiced there, and Upandita, which was one of Gil's teachers. Munindra was a lay person who grew up in India. He was Buddhist. I say he was. He just died last year. And he studied Buddhism, but not meditation. And he was one of the people who ran one of the temples at Bodh Gaya. I believe the temple where they believe the Buddha was enlightened. And then he went to Rangoon to study with Mahasi Sayadaw for many, many years and perfected his meditation, and then went back to Bodh Gaya, taught there. Usilananda was a student of Mahasi Sayadaw. Actually, in his 30s, before that, he was a scholar, and he studied with Mahasi Sayadaw, and then they traveled around the United States in the 70s, and in order to support the Burmese community, Usilananda was asked to stay, and he resides in Half Moon Bay. And he's talked here several times. Now, what's the thing about going back to Munindra was in the 60s, Joseph Goldstein, who's the most senior of a Vipassana teacher in this country, he joined the Peace Corps, and he ran into Munindra and studied meditation under him and fell in love with doing Vipassana meditation. And then that was his starting of practice. During the 60s, for those of you who remember the 60s, there was the hippie movement, and actually a lot of the Vipassana movements was an outgrowth of the hippie movement. Many people, as you know, in those days were into drugs, and they were looking for more psychedelic experiences and organic highs. If you've seen the movie Woodstock, there's a scene in there with a yoga teacher who's teaching people how to get high without drugs. And so many of our present-day teachers were part of the hippie movement, and Wes Nisker, who's a Vipassana teacher with the Spirit Rock Teachers Council, wrote this book, The Big Bang, The Buddha, and The Baby Boom. And for those of you hippies, this will give you hours of enjoyment talking about his drug days and days in San Francisco and then going to India and practicing in India there. So you had Joseph Goldstein going to India. You had Jack Kornfield. He also joined the Peace Corps and went to Thailand and studied under Achin Cha and then went and also studied under Mahasi Sayadaw. And so there were a lot of people who were disillusioned with their native religion here in America, and people in Europe, and they went to Asia to study under teachers there. And then eventually they came back, and Jack Kornfield went and studied for a doctorate in psychology and became a psychotherapist. And so in addition to people studying Vipassana, people were studying Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. And it all came together in the summer of 1974 in Boulder, Colorado. There was a teacher called Chumkwa Rinpoche, who was a Tibetan teacher, who brought all these people together. He brought rabbis together, Sufi teachers together. And it was considered like the summer of love. And people don't know, may know about that. And it was like 1967 or 68 in San Francisco, where all the hippies got together, and it was a real happening. And so this thing at Naropa was considered a real happening. And Trumpa introduced Jack Kornfield to Joseph Goldstein and said, you two ought to teach together. And so they gave classes, and people really liked their classes at Naropa. And then they went around the country teaching Vipassana retreats or insight meditation retreats. And eventually Sharon Salzberg and Jacqueline Schwartz joined them. And they didn't have any place to live. Robert Hall was also a teacher at Spirit Rock, who's also a doctor. He tells a story in those days. He used to put them up at his house, and his kids would run around. And they'd stay at the house, and they'd leave to go teach retreats. So when they stayed at the house, they'd just sleep in the living room. And before they came, his children would run around the house going, the Buddhists are coming, the Buddhists are coming. And then in 1976, those four people and some other people founded the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which is still going strong today. And they have retreats from 1 day to 3 months there. And Jack and Joseph were still teaching retreats around America. And the big one they were teaching was down in Yucca Valley in Southern California. And there were a number of serious practitioners here who eventually became teachers, and they formed Spirit Rock. Now, in those days, as I said, many of the retreats around the country, the people who sat them were like gypsies. They just go around from one retreat to another, and a lot of them didn't have jobs. And one of the things that happened was people would sit at retreats, and they wanted some follow-up on that. And some people just go to retreats once a year because they, like, live in the Midwest, and there were no teachers or sitting centers like this around, so they'd go sit their retreat once a year. And people wanted more than that, and so sitting groups arose. And the center started out as a sitting group in the late 80s, and it was the Noodlemans who started that sitting group. And they'd sit, and they also listened to tape talks. And after a while, Howie Cohn, who was a Spirit Rock teacher, was asked to join the group. And he taught for a while, and he couldn't support it. At that time, Gil was in teacher training with Jack Kornfield. Gil, in addition to studying to Upandita, also studied with Joseph Goldstein and with Sharon Salzberg, and also did years of Zen practice. And Jack considered his practice to have matured enough to go into teacher training. And Gil was also a doctoral student at Buddhist Studies at Stanford. And so he was invited to come here and teach. And they originally met at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, and then they outgrew that and went to the Presbyterian Church in Palo Alto. And they went to the Friends, and every year it got more and more popular. And they had the Monday program, and then the Thursday program, and then a Sunday program was started in Portola Valley. And eventually we purchased this center. Now, one of the things a lot of the teachers did when they came from Asia is they wanted to make the teachings as accessible as possible. So one of the things they definitely didn't want to do is give hell and brimstone sermons to people, because that would turn people off. And so they just wanted to teach the essence of meditation. And over the years, a lot of teachers have wondered, well, maybe they threw out the baby with the bathwater. And because people, a lot of people think that mindfulness is the answer to everything. Oh, just be mindful. Or I remember in the Zen, when I was at the Zen Center, was, you know, any problem, just sit, just sit. And I didn't think that was all the answers. And then one time I got laid off from my job and I was depressed about that. And people at the Zen Center were going, just sit, just sit. And I was dating my wife at that time, and I saw her aunt. And her aunt said, oh, I've got laid off many a times. A couple of days will be over it. And that was really good advice. That's what I really needed, not just sitting with it. A heavy influence of the Vipassana movement in this country has been psychotherapy. And people don't know how that's all going to play out. It's got good aspects and bad aspects. Also, people learned was, teachers have learned, is that Western students have different baggage than Asian students. A lot of people have come with deep psychological problems or feelings of inadequacy. So a lot of what's being done here in the center is really an experiment. And some people get nervous about that, but if you really look at Buddhism when it went to China and even went to Tibet, a lot of that also was quite experimental. I know there was a Buddhist scholar from Stanford who spoke here at a Sati Center event, and he was supposed to talk about Indian Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, Western Buddhism. And he says his colleagues at Stanford believe you really got to look at the old stuff because that's the real stuff. And he doesn't look at it that way. And he went through the whole thing of how in China, how a lot of aspects of Buddhism got changed in China because of the culture. I know one example is if you know that monks traditionally go out on alms rounds for their food and they don't work, and that never went over in China for a number of reasons. First of all, the culture, the weather is cold there and people can't do that, but they also looked down on people who didn't work, so actually the monks grew their own food in the monasteries. And so we have this center here, and we have a lot of our sister center, or Spirit Rock, and IMS in Barre, Massachusetts, and there's also several monasteries related to all these groups. There's one called Abaya Gheri up in Mendocino County, which Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Paseo are the abbots of. Also Ajahn Sundara, who's going to speak here in another month or so. She'll be here for a month. She traces her lineage through that. There are also a number of Western Theravadan or insight groups, which are different than the ones here. The biggest one is led by Goenka. And they actually put on 10-day retreats, a number of them, per year, and they all are on a Dana basis. Shinzen Young, who also studied under Goenka, who I sat with in Los Angeles. I mentioned Bhante Gudaratna. I'm running out of time here, but I was going to talk a little bit about a little of the other Theravadan traditions, but I'll open the floor for questions. And after the talk, I have a bunch of pictures of a lot of these teachers, and I also have the original letter that Mahasi Sayadaw sent to the IRS saying that Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield are appropriate Vipassana teachers, and you should recognize them and give their centers tax-exempt status. So I hope you enjoyed this talk, and hope it was useful and gave you some insight into the history of the center and its lineage. So any questions, comments, anything? Well, it's 8:45, so we will sit for a little bit, and afterwards you can come up and look at the pictures we have here. So we'll do a loving kindness meditation, just take as comfortable a seat as you can. And think of somebody you care about, or some being you care about, be a friend, a relative, or a pet, and let the good feelings you feel about the person arise in you. And now direct those feelings that you feel towards that being, towards yourself. Now taking those good feelings and good intentions and spread it to everyone in this room. And then spread it to everybody on this block. And may your good wishes be spread to everybody in Redwood City. And may your good wishes be spread to everybody on the planet. May they all be content, safe, and happy, and spreading beyond that and to out of the planet and to all the creatures and animals and all the beings that are seen and unseen. May they all be happy. Content and at ease.